I'm Bonnie Glaser, director of the China Power Project at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. In this episode of the China Power Podcast, we're discussing the Chinese maritime militia. We're going to talk about China's maritime militia and how it's being employed in the South China Sea, especially. What are the challenges that China's maritime militia are posing to regional states and to American interests? To help us unpack these issues, we're talking with Dr. Andrew Erickson, professor of strategy at the United States Naval War College. Dr. Erickson's research focuses on Chinese military and maritime studies, and his research has been enormously important in drawing global attention to China's maritime militia. Thanks for joining us today, Andrew.
Thank you, Bonnie. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, help us to understand what a maritime militia is. I understand that Vietnam also has a maritime militia, but other than that, China is the only country that has one. How does a maritime militia differ from traditional coast guards or other law enforcement agencies?
Well, that's a great question, Bonnie, and it definitely deserves more attention than it's received up to this point. A number of nations, including the U.S., have had various naval militias over time that serve as a sort of auxiliary force for the Navy, very traditional support-type missions. The difference with China and also Vietnam is that they have a different type of sea force called a maritime militia that's actually charged with promoting disputed sovereignty claims. So it's not like the Coast Guards of the world, which generally are Boy and Girl Scouts of the Seas promoting safety and good practices like the U.S. Coast Guard. Although there again, China's Coast Guard differs because it also has a sovereignty promotion mission as well, different from the U.S. Coast Guard. But let's look at how this fits into the big picture for China's maritime strategy and its execution. And to make this point clear, I need to draw on the insights of my friend's five-year-old son, who heard my presentation and distilled it this way. He said, China has three navies, the regular navy, the police navy, and the sneaky navy. And that's exactly how China has its sea forces. China's armed forces have three components. Each of those major components has a maritime subcomponent. So China's People's Liberation Army, the military, has the People's Liberation Army Navy, the Navy. There is also a China Coast Guard, which I mentioned, which is increasingly under the leadership of and reflecting the character of China's maritime police under the Ministry of Public Security. And then there's the militia, the third component of China's armed forces, of which the maritime militia is a subcomponent. Now, many people know that China has a major navy. Not everyone knows that at a little over 300 ships, it is in fact the world's largest by number of ships. I believe the official number for the U.S. Navy is 277. Many people know that China has some kind of a Coast Guard. And your organization has done great work on China's Coast Guard and its activities, especially in the South China Sea. Not everyone knows that China's Coast Guard is by far the largest in the world in terms of number of ships, and frankly, is larger than that of all its regional neighbors combined. And then there's the maritime militia. China has the world's largest, and as I said, virtually the only one that's charged with getting involved in maritime disputes and promoting China's position. So what exactly is this maritime militia of China's? We need to think about it carefully since we can't just draw an analogy to some force that we have or our allies have. It's a set of mariners and their vessels which are trained, equipped, and organized directly by the PLA's, China's military's, local military commands. And while at sea, these units, the most advanced units that are charged with intervention involvement in international sea incidents or sensitive sea areas, they typically answer to the PLA chain of command, and they're certain to do so when they're activated for missions. So that's China's maritime militia in a nutshell, a third sea force of China that in its own way plays a direct role in promoting China's position in sovereignty disputes.
So you talked already about some of the purposes for which it uses this militia, promoting its sovereignty claims and asserting China's position on the dispute. How exactly does it do this? How does it advance China's security objectives in places like the South China Sea?
Absolutely. Well, it's important to keep in mind that this is a large and diverse force overall. China's maritime militia has thousands of vessels and thousands of personnel. It's an elite subset at the top that should be of concern to the U.S. and its allies and other regional partners. That's the small elite subset, a relative handful of advanced units that is charged with and empowered to engage in activities in sensitive sea areas regarding disputed sovereignty claims, and if necessary, get involved in and even instigate international sea skirmishes and various types of incidents of that nature. So a bunch of these maritime militia units engage in relatively mundane port security tasks, stuff along the coast, things that no one should be concerned about. But the elite subset is engaged in manifold missions of concern. This includes a long pursued mission of engaging in the gathering of information, engaging in surveillance and reconnaissance. So this includes in July 2014, what was termed the close surveillance of the missile range instrumentation ship USNS Howard O. Lorenzen, for which a unit in Jiangsu, I believe, was highly commended for its activity. So they are monitoring foreign vessels, including U.S. Navy vessels and special mission ships. Then there's the escort protection mission. China's maritime militia was directly involved, played a frontline role in the 2014 oil rig incident with Vietnam, which I know you have covered carefully. We can talk more about that, but essentially, China placed a state-owned oil rig in waters disputed with Vietnam, and when Vietnam tried to send vessels to approach it to assert Vietnamese presence and challenged what it believed was an illegal Chinese activity, China used all three of its sea forces to create a 10 nautical mile plus cordon around the oil rig and forcibly repulse Vietnamese vessels, even reportedly sinking some of them. So the maritime militia played a very direct role in that. Then there's the supporting of Chinese claimed and occupied features. Maritime militia forces have assisted with the construction, the, if you will, the reclaiming and development and supply at Mischief Reef, as well as other disputed features in the Spratlys. Then there's the disruption and harassment of foreign vessels, the most notable incident for the U.S. being the impeccable incident of 2009. And finally, the militia trains, the advanced militia units train for a number of activities that are designed to be able to assist the Navy in actual wartime contingencies.
Can you talk very briefly about the history of this maritime militia? When do you trace it to? Is this a relatively recent phenomenon, or does this go back many decades?
It goes back many decades, virtually to the founding of the People's Republic in 1949. By the 1950s, Chinese policymakers were looking, the early 1950s, they were looking for ways to both fend off nationalist challenges along the coast from Taiwan, the KMT in Taiwan, at a time when China didn't have a navy worthy of the name. But China, mainland China, the PRC, did have these huge coastal fishing populations. So on the one hand, it wanted to use them, enlist them in the service of the new Chinese state. On the other hand, it wanted to bring them under greater state control. So building a maritime militia killed two birds with one stone.
So how is this maritime militia trained and directed? Do we see coordination with the Coast Guard, with the People's Liberation Army, Navy, and who holds operational authority over these forces?
That is a critical point, and it is one that I believe we've made clear. My colleague Connor Kennedy and I at the China Maritime Studies Institute, in our 3+ years of intensive research, the bottom line is this: China's maritime militia is a state-organized, state-developed, and state-controlled force. It operates under a direct military chain of command, and it conducts Chinese state-sponsored activities. It's locally supported and raised the local branches of China's military commands are directly involved with it on a day-to-day basis. But it answers to the very top of China's centralized bureaucracy, Commander-in-Chief Xi Jinping himself. So there is no federal state distinction here akin to the U.S. National Guard. There's no plausible deniability. And this is further reflected in the training. A number of authoritative Chinese sources document in detail the way in which some of the most advanced Chinese maritime militia units periodically receive training directly from China's Navy. And moreover, in multiple international sea incidents, we can observe quite clearly, using open sources, the direct coordination among all three of China's sea forces in real time. So whether it's the impeccable incident in 2009, or it's the oil rig incident of 2014, all three of China's sea forces were there, they were all communicating and coordinating, and they were acting together in a relatively effective manner. So someone asked me yesterday at the Jamestown Foundation's China conference, how effective is this coordination? And my answer is this: effective enough to keep winning in the gray zone without escalating to war, and that's just the way that China wants it.
So when the media covers China's actions in the South China Sea, there's often discussion also by experts of what people refer to as salami slicing tactics. So what does this term mean, and how does the maritime militia fit into this strategy?
Well, you've put your finger on exactly what China is doing to advance its sovereignty claims and its broader strategic interests in the South China Sea. And I know you've studied those incidents very carefully, and I know that your project has a detailed, even quantitative analysis of those different incidents. And I agree that it adds up to salami slicing. This is a long-term, incremental approach. You can call it calibrated coercion without killing, or ideally without killing, or what I just referred to as winning without fighting in the gray zone in peacetime, although it can be a very contested, competitive, and coercive version of the peacetime. What China tries to do is play things out over the long run, not escalate above a certain level, and take advantage of the fact fact that its maritime militia, its Third Sea Force, can play at a relatively low level of intensity so as not to, from China's perspective, provoke an American or an allied response. But at the same time, having enough force to really intimidate and challenge China's weaker and less capable neighbors. But here's a case in point. Let's look at the 2012 Scarborough Shoal incident. So while China did not precipitate the incident in an operational sense, its maritime militia was right on the front line, asserting sovereignty around the shoal and exploiting its resources, right in the Philippines' claimed exclusive economic zone, right around a feature on the Philippines' continental shelf claimed by the Philippines. When the Philippines tried to actually enforce that claim by boarding and inspecting these maritime militia vessels that were illegally harvesting endangered marine species, that's when China pounced on the situation. This is a very Chinese characteristic, seizing on some excuse to sort of pounce and have a disproportionate response. So at that point, China vectored Coast Guard vessels to the scene, created a standoff with the Philippines. My understanding, although I don't know the inside details, is that the U.S. Tried to broker an agreement to return to the status quo ex ante, return to what happened before, stand down. China did not honor what was reportedly its end of that bargain. Instead, it occupied the area, it surrounded the area, it sealed off the shoal, and it brought back those maritime militia forces to form an outside cordon and prevent Philippine vessels from fishing anywhere near the shoal. Now, since China has pursued a nuanced strategy of allowing some Philippine fishing vessels back to fish near the shoal, but China is very much now in control of this feature. So that's a perfect example of salami slicing. China seized the shoal, China advanced its claims without firing a shot, and over time, China is determined to decide what it's going to do and try to influence, really hold this over the Philippines in the process. And oh, by the way, I can find no evidence that the U.S. ever imposed a cost for China reportedly reneging on its very important promise. So this is salami slicing that is sliced so fine that apparently the U.S. didn't respond successfully.
Last year, we were witnesses at the House Armed Services Committee's Sea Power and Projection Forces. And you mentioned at the time in your testimony that the maritime militia is evolving and that it may be finding new aggressive models. So can you describe some of the more recent changes and if these changes in any way more clearly define the role of maritime militia as combatants or as fishermen?
This is an extremely important point. Already, as of a few years ago, China's maritime militia was very much, and it's long been, a key component of China's armed forces. So this is in no way a civilian entity. This is in no way a collection of, if you will, innocent, random, patriotic fishermen. China likes to have that camouflage and likes to misportray it in that way, but it's not the case at all. Our language and our understanding needs to reflect that. So up until 2015, there was an old type of, a traditional type of maritime militia. Most of the militia men and some militia women as well had civilian jobs, but could be called up in an armed force capacity. But now there's a new development on top of this, namely new units emerging that appear to employ elite forces full-time as militarized professionals. So the traditional force, it's raised from civilian marine industry workers, primarily fishermen, fisher folk, if you will, from China's fishing fleet, the world's largest. They keep their day jobs, but they're also organized in and trained in China's maritime militia, and they're called up when needed. So the elite vanguard units, if you will, that were engaged in international sea incidents in recent years were primarily of this nature. And Scarborough Shoal is a case in point because the forces active by the shoal in 2012 were activated apparently right in the middle of the incident. But now there's a new force, a more professionalized, militarized vanguard. And this is drawing on military recruits, offers high salaries, formidable purpose-built vessels with apparently no fishing responsibilities as far as we can see. The core model is Sansha in the Paracels starting in 2015. This unit has 84 advanced vessels. If you can show some pictures of them on your website, they'll make the point very clear. They're nearly 200 feet long. They're probably about 750 tons at their largest. This is enormous for a fishing vessel. They have powerful mast-mounted water cannons, which are highly useful for aggressive spraying of other vessels, but not normal in that way on a fishing vessel. And they have very prominent external rails on the side, which are very useful for ramming. Some of the best available leaders are being recruited to be commanding officers for these vessels. And real money is being offered. A $25,000 annual U.S. salary and a whole range of benefits. That goes very far in a Chinese fishing community, if you will. And there's a goal of, and a precedent already, of recruiting from demobilized PLA forces, which are increasingly becoming available as part of Xi Jinping's 300,000 troop reduction to make the PLA literally leaner and meaner. We can see from publicly available AIS data, as I know your organization uses as well, we follow these vessels and we can see that they engage in rotational forward deployment, Navy style, to various Chinese-occupied disputed features in the Spratlys, and we don't see any signs of fishing. So the traditional maritime militia was already not a normal civilian fishing force. It was very much part of the armed forces. But this is taking things to a whole new level of professionalization and militarization. And there should be, I can only imagine, legal implications of this. And there are definitely policy implications, which I hope we'll touch on later on.
So you described earlier how China's maritime militia and its Coast Guard and then its Navy are sometimes used together. Now, this is often referred to, of course, as the cabbage strategy. So can you explain, maybe give an example as to how this cabbage strategy has been used effectively in the South China Sea?
Absolutely. Well, first of all, the term cabbage strategy is not used widely in authoritative Chinese sources, but it's a useful handle or phrase to describe what China's actually doing in various incidents. Not just theoretical, we've seen it. We've seen it, for example, in the Scarborough Shoal incident of 2012, where both Chinese Coast Guard and maritime militia forces surrounded the shoal and prevented Philippine vessels of any type from approaching effectively. An even more comprehensive and dramatic example occurred in 2014 with the oil rig incident. This is, to my knowledge, China's largest and most sophisticated 3C force gray zone operation to date. Essentially, they put a layer of cabbage leaves of vessels around their oil rig to protect it and to prevent Vietnam from challenging this imposition of Chinese sovereignty assertion. It was a formidable effort. There was a cordon of about 10 nautical miles that China around the rig that China succeeded in maintaining. And according to media sources, it used four PLA Navy vessels, probably about 35 to 40 Coast Guard vessels, and then more than 40 China maritime militia vessels. We can, in Chinese language sources, find the breakdown on that. There were 29 vessels from the Sanya Maritime Militia, 10 from the Tanmen Maritime Militia, at least one from Dongfang City, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. This is very knowable. And while more research should be done on this incident, it seems like the maritime militia vessels are used to engage with similar looking or similar categories of vessels on the other side. So it seems like these maritime militia vessels went after the Vietnamese trawler style vessels. Now, for all I know, Vietnam had its own maritime militia involved in this. That's how Vietnam can operate as well. But China uses a like approach of vessels to try to keep the appearance of managing escalation. They want to achieve their objectives with the least escalation possible. And this cabbage strategy is a way to do that. Keep a maritime militia layer where it's not the same as sending naval vessels to attack a much, much smaller vessel, but at the same time, making it difficult, if not impossible, for the other side to respond effectively.
So finally, let's talk about the response of the United States to China's use of the maritime militia. Is the U.S. doing enough? You mentioned earlier that the United States did not impose costs in 2012 in the Scarborough Shoal incident. What can the United States do to be really more proactive in tackling this issue with China? What are your policy recommendations?
Well, I'm glad you raised that because at CMSI, we strive to use our research to provide unclassified tools to support U.S. policy development. We focus on analyzing in depth what China is actually doing, and policymakers need to weigh this and figure out for themselves what's the most effective approach. But with regards to China's maritime militia, I think there's a more direct implication and a more obvious implication than there would be in some other areas. And that is because China's maritime militia is having a negative impact on regional stability, regional security, and the rules-based system that we and our allies and partners naturally want to maintain for the good of all in the South China Sea and beyond. And this third sea force of China is thriving in its efforts to do so because it's largely been able to operate in the shadows. And we can greatly reduce its ability to do so by starting with revealing a lot more about it, revealing to deter. And there's still a lot more room for improvement in that area. Regrettably, to my knowledge, during the entire Obama administration, there was no U.S. federal government public statement coming out of Washington explicitly acknowledging and documenting the existence of China's maritime militia. How can we even begin to deter a force that the U.S. government will not mention publicly? The lone voice in the, virtually the lone voice in the wilderness of a U.S. government official was Admiral Scott Swift, the commander of the U.S. Pacific Fleet, doing valiant work out of Honolulu, mentioning this Third Sea Force, both in his interactions and in his media appearances. But that was still not the same as a report or a public statement coming out of Washington. As a result, the subject was insufficiently understood. I know for a fact that many of our allies and partners were confused to the extent that they had a sense of what was going on. They still did not feel fully empowered to make moves of their own because they wanted the U.S. to lead and provide them some top cover. The big progress that's occurred to date has been the latest Pentagon China report, which contains three paragraphs specifically on China's maritime militia. That's an excellent start, but far more is needed. There need to be more public U.S. statements with a U.S. government stamp of approval so that the U.S. public, the policymaking community, understands unambiguously the nature of this challenge so that our allies are informed, energized, reassured, and motivated to make similar statements of their own. There are further steps that need to be taken. We need to raise this issue with our Chinese interlocutors in a wide variety of meetings, not just the annual MMCA talks where disagreements are often aired time and time again, but in the lead up to various summits and interactions that China wants, so that China has to actually deal with the issue to make progress toward arranging summits and arranging bilateral naval exchanges. What's more, I personally believe that we increasingly need to coordinate and link our interaction with China's Navy to the activities of all three of its sea forces. So to put it in plain language, I don't think we should allow the PLA Navy to bear hug the U.S. Navy as a good cop for photo ops and naval diplomacy and learning best practices while China's Coast Guard and maritime militia run around the East China Sea and the South China Sea doing the dirty work as bad cops. We need to make it clear that that kind of negative behavior is going to have an impact on bilateral naval-to-naval relations, in my opinion. And if that means finally getting serious about imposing preconditions on future invitations to RIMPAC, then I think that's what we need to do to make it clear that we finally mean business. I have many recommendations in the research on my website at AndrewErickson.com, and I'd be happy to offer further details to anyone who's interested. But this is where it all starts. So many things in managing U.S.-China relations are difficult and have been thought of before, and we need to keep working. But as you know from your long experience in this area, it's a difficult and challenging thing, and it's a long-term issue. Working to better reveal and deter China's maritime militia is an unusual area in which there's still a considerable amount of low-hanging fruit, and there's a lot more that we can do in a fairly simple and straightforward way. So let's roll up our sleeves and get to work, and I thank you very much for this opportunity to discuss this with you.
Well, thank you, Andrew. Your research, all of your writings, your website, and hopefully this podcast has contributed greatly, I think, to encouraging people's awareness and getting people to think about the problem and how to address it in the future. So I want to thank you very much. We've been talking with Dr. Andrew Erickson, who's from the China Maritime Studies Institute at the Naval War College. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Bonnie. Always a pleasure.